From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today it's a special holiday edition with two original stories of the season. Zelda Lockhart is a visiting associate professor in the creative writing department at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She is the 2010 winner of the Piedmont Laureate for Literature, and she is the author of three novels, including Fifth Born and Fifth Born 2, The Hundredth Turtle. She joins me now. Professor Zelda Lockhart, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel.
This first book, Fifth Born, tells the story of Odessa Blackburn in St. Louis, Missouri, and rural Mississippi. Odessa loses her grandmother when she's three. She suffers through sexual abuse perpetrated by her father, whom she saw kill his own brother. The next book, Fifth Born 2, The Hundredth Turtle, holds the story that you'll read for us today. Where does this second book pick up Odessa's story?
So the second book picks up where Odessa has been ostracized by the family that she has grown up in of seven siblings other than herself and her mother, who's not her biological mother, and her father, who has who molested her in childhood, and she's been left in Mississippi, and she ends up living with her biological mother, who she did not know up until this point, and she's 13 years old, and that brings with it, as you know, lots of attitude, and also she's has gone through lots of struggle. So she and this woman, who's very quiet, and this woman is very she's very to herself and very anxious at times. They are living together, and where we come in is their first Christmas after several other struggles that they have had.
Would you read the story for us?
Absolutely. And it's told first person in Odessa's voice. There was no Christmas. I waited for 2 days before school holidays started for LMA to mention it, but no mention. The usual silence over a plate of pickled beets, mashed potatoes, fried rabbit, which I always pretended was fried chicken that I ate with a knife instead of my fingers. I didn't want to feel the tiny bones beneath the flesh. I didn't want to remember the feel of Daddy's kill between my fingers. I finished reading the novel, The Mimosa Tree. All the prophet children escaped their woes in Chicago and happily returned to the country comfort of Goose Elk, North Carolina, where simple things like foraging for food were possible in those troubled times. And I shut that book. I wasn't convinced of their happy ending. What about Christmas? What would they eat when the blight had killed the crops? Like Ella May said, you can't cure or can what you didn't kill or pick. The beans on the cook stove bubbled in a quiet boil. Beans I picked to steady my mind the day after Daddy left me here in Mississippi. Beans that had been given all fall to dry and were being softened on the stove. Their steam kept the fires in the fireplace and the wood stove from drying the air of the house. Sometimes in moments like those, nothing on my mind but the smell of beans. I pictured them, my older siblings, Tawanda and Laverne, riding on a city bus through the gray streets of St. Louis to the mall, where the smell of food and the sound of Christmas songs and the colored lights gave a false warmth in the chest that evaporated on the bus ride back to the west side. I lay down on the rug. I adjusted my glasses, imagining them giggling and wrapping glass jars of cheap bubble bath. Through the fingerprints from my glasses, I looked up to where Ella Mae leaned over the table using a lamp and her $1 Walgreens bifocals to assist her in threading the needle. I tried to imagine her wrapping presents, but the image was as elusive as the thread through the needle. She licked the end of the thread again and concentrated on the precision of making the thin strand fit through the tiny space, a concentration that I broke. I said to her, I need glasses. I think my head grew last summer. There was nothing but the simmering hiss of steam escaping the pot top. So I went in with what I really wanted to say. Can we just get a Christmas tree? She spoke with her eyes still on the needle and her pinched fingers and answered with me with one short, simple word, no. My brow tightened at her abrupt, monotone answer, and I moved my head forward on my neck, not realizing I'd expected a yes. Why not? I thought about the hypocrisy of asking me if there was anything that was going to help me not miss St. Louis so much, and then just saying no in one breath without asking me why I wanted the damn thing. She said, Odessa, I ain't studying about stuff that ain't real. I rolled my eyes the way my brother Lamont might have in a moment like this, and I thought, what is real? Rag rugs, fires, food from last summer, no TV? What's real is boring. Nobody visits us, and I'm glad we went to New York, but that was a month ago. Once I started the barrage of complaints in my head, I remembered that I still had not tried to draw her out the way my brother had asked, without waging war. But now it would be awkward to break the rhythm of my retaliation. I said, everybody at school has people coming for Christmas or is going someplace or has a bunch of sisters and brothers and is going to West Point Nursery to get a Christmas tree. Hush, Ella Mae said quietly. She still did not look at me. Having successfully threaded the needle, she was now stitching the split in my favorite skirt, and I wanted her to yell at me or do something to make me feel real. No, I don't want to hush. I was up off the floor, still standing on my rug though, but my toes gripped the grooves of the rags to hold me still where I leaned forward toward Ella Mae's quiet space in her chair. My voice hit the blunt wall. I said, I don't want to hush. I feel like I'm dead and you don't care if anybody thinks you alive, but I ain't you. You can't even cry out loud. Even with that stab, Ella Mae did not turn away from her stitching to look at me, and I was tethered like a June bug on a string. I imagined my little brothers, Benson, Daryl, and Jesse watching a Charlie Brown Christmas. The spot on the floor where I belonged was empty, and the three of them moved in tight to fill the space. That's when she just said to me, get your coat on. Ella Mae said it again, just leave all that and get your coat on. She waved at the breaded rabbit's legs. We'll be back before anything can creep out and eat it. I opened my mouth to question her, but she was already up, getting her coat off the hook. And then she sat at the end of the bench and stuck her feet in boots. Almost left behind, I followed her command, quickly slipping my sock feet into the coolness of my boots, hat, scarf, and one arm in my CPO jacket. We drove through the cold, dry air, leafless trees, blue sky. I didn't have the heart to tell her that West Point Nursery wouldn't really be open on Christmas Day. We cracked the windows on the truck to keep the windshield from fogging up while we had the heat on. The red, rusty truck switched through the twists and turns of the neighborhood where smells of stuffing and normalcy tempted my jealousy. Ella Mae cranked her neck out to see the daytime decorations outside of people's houses. She nodded at one and said, that looks cute, don't you think? I was relieved to be led into her thoughts again. She pulled into the empty parking lot of the Walgreens, and we sat there a moment. Ella Mae staring out, calculating the reality, and me trying to wait, be respectful, not say the first thing on my mind. They won't be open on Christmas. And then a cackling dark cloud of starlings landed in a swoop of squeaking. They lifted up in a wave and landed again. Ella Mae turned and grinned at me like a little girl. Wow, I said, reaching for the crank for the window and then thinking about the consequence of birds overhead. They lifted up and down again in another wave and did it again, making a black ocean of the parking lot, making the red truck the center, the red buoy in that sea. She put her hand on mine. That's what I do on Christmas, she said. And I giggled and giggled, feeling discomfort at the way the air entered my lungs cold and exited warm. When we got home, I headed toward the house, bracing against the chilly air, but Ella Mae tugged at the elbow of my CPO jacket, and the softness of her smile said there was another adventure yet to be had. I returned the smile with a laugh that tumbled out a little easier. She held up the frame of the hacksaw. "I'll put the blade on this thing, and you run in the house and put the rabbit meat and the stuff in the icebox before something really do get it." She chuckled, and the sound of her laughter gave me energy to bound up the steps in one leap. With little clouds of breath in the cold air above us, we walked side by side to the naked trees, through the stubborn green of the live oaks, and to the tiny fir trees that insisted on growing beneath them. Ella Mae handed me the saw and gestured at the nearest fir. I knelt down and held the blade up to the trunk, but Ella Mae said, "Don't hold the saw like that, and let's apologize or something to the tree before you go hacking away at it like that." A chuckle escaped both of our throats, but we were silent for a moment, letting the damp air hold our wishes. I remembered that I could cut my kneecap off or put my eye out or any number of horrible things if I didn't use the saw right. I bit my bottom lip and worked while Ella Mae coached me. "Now you're doing the opposite. Don't be scared, just cut the thing." My chocolate brown scarf became more sloppy around my neck as heat escaped from my body, and I sawed back and forth. Little fir twigs fell on my head and face, but I ignored them, my focus full on finishing before Ella Mae could tell me to move and let her do it. But instead, I heard her say something that sounded like, "You man." I stopped sawing and looked up at her, the silhouette of her face against the lace of tiny green oak leaves and sky. Ella Mae's stern look, as if her face had been molded that way, like the day she had walked me to Grandmama's casket, the color of yellow and black lace veils blending with the oak tree backdrop and the last of the sunlight. She softened into a smile that reflected the lips of my grandmama and someone who I did not yet know, but whose smile was stored in hers. And she said it again, "You mine."
Zelda Lockhart, visiting associate professor of creative writing at UNCW, reading from her book, Fifth Born to the 100th Turtle. Professor Lockhart, this is in the voice of Odessa Blackburn. Who is she, and why, who is she to you? And why was her story important to write?
Thanks for asking that. She is me in a lot of ways in terms of the wounds that I have suffered of childhood sexual abuse, of being abandoned and ostracized from my family for telling the truth of what happened to me. She is every little girl who has lived with that kind of burden inside of her house and outside of her house. She's Black, born in Mississippi. She is a little girl who has a spirit that is triumphant and enduring and resilient. And so it's a story that I feel like needed to be written, because like myself, there's so many people who have they are walking around making change in the world and doing their work and happy. And there is huge backstory of how is it that this person was capable of getting to this place in their life when so much had happened at the outset of their life. So that's why her story is so important to me.
So she has to walk away from her biological family to find out for herself what family really means. So how does she do that, and what does family ultimately wind up meaning for her?
So there's lots more that she ends up going through in the story. Um, But family means for her, much like it means for me. You know, in some ways, you might have been born into a world, into a life, into a household of people, into biology that is yours. And it is heritage, it is ancestry, and it can be claimed in all of those ways. But it does not, in the actions of those people in your family, it does not define who it is that you get to be in this world. And you can go searching, as Odessa did, for the parts of yourself that you feel like you have been denied. And in doing that, you end up finding connection with other people, which is family. So for me, that's why I have LMA in the story. LMA is really a reflection of my adult self. So in the story, it's, you know, if you think about it allegorically, then it's little girl me reconnecting with strong adult me, which is, you know, LMA being the other mother, being the original mother that she ends up connecting with and finding and shaping the rest of her life based on that mothering.
Mm. You know, so you read this Christmas story, and so many midwinter celebrations, whether Kwanzaa or Christmas or Hanukkah, winter solstice, it's about calling and finding the light during the darkest time of the year. So how does this story call the light for you?
Because in this piece of the story, it's also like what we were just saying about, you know, family. You might have the roles of family, biological, and then you go seek it. And it doesn't have to mean what the roles of family mean. It means where your heart connects. And so what LMA is offering Odessa in this moment, Odessa is saying, I want Christmas, even though Christmas and her memories, you know, is really just, you know, doing things with her siblings that is not really things that she wants to do, like going shopping on the bus in the city. But she's showing her that that Christmas and any celebration like that is about going out and seeking and being with what makes your heart sing. And so she shows her just the simplest thing that is a decoration in nature, and it's a decoration in life, of being able to see birds in the middle of something that is empty, like the Walgreens parking lot, you know, and seeing those birds create an ocean out of their bodies. And so she's showing her that there is light, particularly in nature, because there's a lot of nature in the book, there's a lot of nature in my life, and a lot of nature in everything I write, but showing her to reach for the light in other ways.
And so many people during this holiday season are struggling with job losses, the death of loved ones, socially distanced celebrations, which is increasing isolation for people. We know a lot more people are struggling with food insecurity this year. What do you think some of the ways are that people can connect to the light and practice self-care? And I want to talk a little bit more about self-care, because I know that's something you talk about, and it's part of a lot of your life. But what would you say to folks who are kind of looking at this, at the onset of this holiday season, as a pretty bleak time?
One of the things that I've been doing is to ask myself, where are the gifts? Because, you know, life is dichotomous. Where there is death, there is life. The two sit pretty close together. Nature teaches us that, which is why I spend so much time in it, is that where you may see one thing die, you see another thing gain life and resilience in that same moment. And that's one of the ways that I've been trying to look at things. Like if I'm stuck inside and I can't go outside, then what is it inside that I have not been able to accomplish? And we can think about that literally and metaphorically at the same time. You know, if you cannot be outside, if you cannot be in a way where you are interacting with people, going to work And if you lose your job, you know, what is it that you can do inside of your heart and soul? What has been neglected that you haven't been able to get at because of all of this, the tarrying around to accomplish or to even survive on the outside? What is it that you can go in the inside and do and have that work so that you can have better life when COVID finally is over and ends? And so, you know, writing for people is, and storytelling is something that you can do. You can get on the phone, you can go on Zoom, you can say, tell me a story, you know, tell me something that you haven't told me before about something funny that happened in your life. And we just prompt each other and get back to some of those kind of ways where we share our inner lives with each other. And that doesn't cost anything. I mean, it may cost some people their hard exterior shell. That's another thing that happens in this story is that Odessa is also teaching LMA. You know, so some of the things that I didn't read here is where Odessa is drawing LMA out through story, you know, asking her questions, and that LMA doesn't want to answer because she's been so singular and hardened, you know, but that is another way that they begin to connect is through the stories.
So that's interesting, the value of letting go of that hard outer shell. And you had said to me earlier that some of your students come to you and say, I want to write fiction so that I can hide. And you laugh.
Yes, I do.
So why do we need to go there? Why do we need to let go of that hard outer shell and be vulnerable and share some of these things that have been secrets or that we think are too shameful to share?
Because without that, we've got nothing. You know, we're just like those starlings on that parking lot. You know, we organize ourselves and we live and we survive in flocks. We are in packs. You know, we're pack animals. We cannot survive alone. And when life gets us down and very difficult things happen to us, one of the ways that we could react, and a lot of us do, and it's even an initial way to react that is okay, is that we grow an exoskeleton, we grow a scab, and we need that. You know, we need that to protect us and to heal, but we can't keep that. You know, it's like we don't become smooth again unless we let that go. So we have to let that shell go when it's time for it to be let go so that we can have love and connection with each other again. And a lot of times we go to protect ourselves by saying, I'm not telling any of my business. And then we wonder why it is that we don't have intimacy, what we're not connected, why it is that we don't get along at work because nobody's willing to share that they had a hard night. They just got a divorce, or they got, you know, sometimes you have to share those things and allow yourself to be vulnerable in order to be able to then even connect with other people who might be able to help you, or they might have a similar story. So you might grow kinship, or so I always say you might gain food, medicine, and kinship. And that's the ecology of us sharing our truths with each other, is that we get to be connected and help each other to heal and grow in that way.
And so you talk about self-care in a blog on your website, and you also talk about it with Natasha Thomas in a video called Black Creative Healing. And I'm sorry if you can hear Drake, my dog, in the background. He's dreaming and yelping a little bit. And so you wrote, you have to lead the charge in self-care by saying no to activities that may seem like business as usual for your colleagues. When you've been indoctrinated with the idea that you are last on the priority list, and that idea has been there so long that it's almost cellular, how can a person begin to flip that on its head and put their own oxygen mask on first?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a couple answers to that, a couple of hundred, but I'll say one thing is to go, even if you're just standing at a bus stop, turn your eyes away from humanity for a minute and look at the other things in nature and watch how those things in nature seek their resilience. And that'll tell you a lot. And then the other thing that brings it a little bit more home to just the reality of our everyday lives as humans is, you know, you find colleagues, you know, find someone who has what I call similar to whatever identity it is at the time that is being oppressed. Yeah. You know, so depending on who we are and where we are, we might be suffering at work because one or the other of our identities is being oppressed, you know. And so find the folks in your identity group. And just like what you see in that video with Natasha and I, that where there's an ease of not having to explain everything up to that point in your life of how you got to this point. And then on top of that, having to explain why it is that you need what you need in that workspace. You yes. find those colleagues and connect with them.
Yes, and that is our time. You're listening to Coastline UNCW. Professor Zelda Lockhart, thank you so much for being with us today.
Rachel, I really appreciate being here.
When we come back from this break, author of The Roomy Prescription, Melody Moisey, brings her own holiday story. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. It's a special holiday edition today. We're hearing two original stories. Melody Moisey is a visiting associate professor of creative writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She is an attorney, and she's the author of The Roomy Prescription, which we discussed on this show earlier this year in April. That was back during the dawn of the pandemic. Melody Moisey, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Rachel. I'm so happy to be here.
So happy to have you with us today, especially with this story that you're bringing. But first of all, the story, which comes from The Roomy Prescription, that's a memoir that chronicles your journey through some mental health challenges, and it kind of tells the story of how the ancient Sufi mystic and poet Rumi led you through. So before we get to your story, can you just remind us how the poetry of Rumi opened you to this new pathway for healing?
You know, I grew up with Rumi in my life. My dad has been a fan of his for a very long time. And like most children of what I call addicts, because he was very much a Rumi addict, I grew up taking that poetry for granted, because every lesson my father ever taught me came with a poem. Usually from Rumi, occasionally from Hafez or Sa'di, but these Persian Sufi poets were what I grew up with as an Iranian American, were just alive in my home in Ohio. So growing up taking that for granted and then not realizing how much it had impacted me until I effectively lost my mind. I had a manic episode and ultimately a psychotic break that coincided with a mystical experience. And all of those things together brought me back to Rumi's poetry, because this poetry that my dad had been reciting to me my entire life had suddenly made sense to me. Because Rumi really lauds this notion of insanity, but he does it out of a way that, you know, all humans are crazy to a certain extent, which is sort of the basis of this book, that it's not just those of us with mental health conditions who have lost it. All of us have lost it. And Rumi provides this sort of gateway of saying, since we're all crazy to begin with, you may as well choose the right kind of crazy. And for him, that is the kind that comes from love. And that is the kind of insanity that creates a mystic, as opposed to the kind of insanity that creates a lunatic, or what we would call an extremist or a fundamentalist, which is the kind of insanity that is driven by fear. So we have that option to choose love or to choose fear in every step of our lives. And that's what Rumi really woke me up to. And for me to be able to show love for myself and to say that with this diagnosis, it wasn't a curse, that it was just as much a gift, despite the fact that everyone around me, apart from my father and Rumi, were pretty much telling me this was a curse, which ultimately it was absolutely the opposite of that.
Oh, and we need to talk a little bit more about that idea too, because you've tweeted about this. But first of all, you are Muslim, Iranian American, as you mentioned, not Christian.
Yeah.
But you have a Christmas story in your memoir, and that's what you're going to read for us. Can you help us understand why a Christmas story? And go ahead and set it up for us.
Yeah, I love Christmas. I've always sort of loved it. And I think that's when you don't have something growing up and everybody else does have it, you learn either to just completely hate it or to go the opposite way. And I certainly went the opposite way. So I'm a big fan of Christmas. We didn't have Christmas trees growing up. So like when I grew up, I was like, I'm going to have them. And I have three in my house right now. So I'm a big fan of it. And, you know, for the record, Jesus is a prophet. May peace and blessings be upon him in Islam. So it's not like Jesus doesn't have a place in Islam. He has a very, very big place in Islam. So the celebration of the prophet is absolutely something that is respected and acceptable. It's just the idea that it happened on this date would be something that we contest, that it didn't happen actually on this date. Sorry about that. I think my dad was calling me on FaceTime and it interrupted us. I apologize for that.
That's okay. Hi, Dad. He's an important part of this whole story anyway. I mean, he's the one who helped to give rise to this book and talk to you about, you know, you were going back to kind of your religious heritage and traditions and cultural traditions to write this memoir, and it began as an intellectual idea for you. And it was your father,
yeah,
Ahmad, who said, this needs to be a real practice for you, not a means to an end. And you really took that in, and that's what this writing process became for you. Where is your practice today?
You know, pandemic has been tough for me, and my practice is trying to show myself and everyone around me as much mercy and grace as I can, to the point that I have come to accept that survival is victory. And in a lot of ways, for a lot of us right now, that really is the case, because some of us are not surviving this quite literally. So I've tried to be kind of merciful with myself, because I haven't been as productive as I would like to be. My focus has been really shifted, and it's hard to maintain just a basic level of focus that's required to be a writer, you know? So I'm basically saying, you know, I can have as many ideas as I want right now, but I'm not required to be writing in the same way as I normally would, because of the fact that I just can't, quite honestly. It's not just is it hard for me to write right now, it's also really hard for me to read, which is part of my identity. So I've had to be a lot more gracious with myself than usual.
Such a good lesson for all of us. Such a good practice. So this Christmas story that you have, set this up for us.
So this is after I spent a month in San Diego visiting my dad, and just thinking, just so full of so much hubris that I thought that I could learn and do everything I needed to do for this book that ultimately took a good 5 years. To finish, that I could do it in a month. So I spent a month with my parents in San Diego, and then I was coming back to Raleigh, where we lived at the time. And my husband picked me up at the airport when I came back. And this was the longest time we'd been apart, I think since we got married. So it had been an entire month that we'd been apart.
Okay. So whenever you're ready.
Sure. Matthew meets me inside the Raleigh-Durham airport, which is weird. We're both more the curbside, airport police taunting, drive in circles, texting till you get there, kiss and fly type. For us, greeting each other in airports is for soldiers, migrants, and SAFs. And given we were none of the above, it seems like a waste of time. Nonetheless, here stands Matthew, waiting. Flanked by eager military families, church groups, and delusional romantic comedy addicts, he actually hops when he spots me and my leopard print carry-on. We rush to hug one another before I realize we look exactly like one of those delusional rom-com addicts I just made fun of a sentence ago. Apparently, the only thing that separates us from every other sad sap is a month apart, a fact that becomes all the more evident when we get home. "You did not," I say as I walk through the front door. "Oh, I did," Matthew beams. The living room is immaculate, and despite the fact that it's barely December, the Christmas tree is already up, fully decorated, fully lit. For background, and even more evidence that I'm not the sensible cynic I apparently imagine myself to be, I love Christmas. Yes, I'm Muslim. Yes, Muslims don't do Christmas. And yes, I don't care. By contrast, Matthew's Christmas spirit vacillates between indifferent and insurgent. He was raised categorically Catholic, with trees, presents, lights, midnight mass, the whole Yuletide package. I was raised vaguely Muslim, with none of it. Christmas at our house was about celebrating my mom, because it happens to be her birthday, and pillaging the pantry because there's apparently a law in Dayton, Ohio that requires you to send a box of Esther Price chocolates to the doctor who delivered your babies every year at Christmas for the rest of your life. So while my sister and I were singing happy birthday and binging on Buckeyes as we tossed aside photos of all the kids my dad had delivered since what felt like the beginning of time, Matthew and his brother were singing carols and opening gifts they had actually requested. Astoundingly, despite all the Christmas cheer at his childhood home in the Catskills, Matthew was decidedly agnostic by the time I met him at Wesleyan University. I was a freshman studying philosophy and Latin American literature. He was a sophomore studying economics and Russian. I never noticed him before he chased me out of Olin Library to ask me out. Only a few months into my college career, I had no interest in dating anyone. Still, his nerve and humor impressed me. So we became friends. And 3 years later, we fell in love. I'd like to say that it was my example that inspired Matthew's conversion to Islam, but it wasn't. He converted because he read the Quran and it spoke to him. We were nearly engaged by then, but apart from suggesting decent translations, I had nothing to do with Matthew's conversion. Even still, my father was livid and blamed me when he found out. First, he insisted that I should have forbidden Matthew from converting, as though that were something I was capable of doing. Then he urged Matthew to respect and embrace the faith into which he had been born, insisting that there was no meaningful difference between Christianity and Islam anyway. But Matthew never identified as Christian as an adult. And he had been studying the Quran for years by that point. So he made up his mind. Personally, I was happy he had found a faith that resonated with him and that we happened to share it. But his conversion neither made nor broke the deal for me. For one, both of us were adamant about never wanting kids and didn't anticipate getting into any religious debates over how to raise our cats. More importantly, I was already so in love with Matthew by then that he could have worshiped dandelions and I still would have married him. Aside from my father's vocal protests, which subsided with time, the rest of my family cared even less than I did about Matthew's religion. My sister had already married a white Southern Baptist from South Carolina, so my marrying a white Muslim convert from upstate New York was far from radical. All this to say, with no intended disrespect for Matthew's convictions, I highly suspect that one of the greatest perks of converting to Islam for him has been the ability to more fully dismiss the Christmas holiday. He can go on for days about why Christmas sucks. The commercialism, the eggnog, the murdering of trees, the sweaters, the massive historical inaccuracies, the crowds, the exclusion of religious minorities, the creepy Santas, the lies we tell children, and the fruitcake. While I dispute none of these horrors, I'm still a sucker for Christmas. The lights, the evergreens, the sugar cookies, the glitter-dusted pine cones, the snow, the holly, the carols, the steaming hot chocolate, the gingerbread houses, the crackling fireplaces, and of course, the endless filmography. Much to Matthew's dismay, I start watching Christmas movies right around Halloween, and I don't stop until weeks after New Year's. I can't believe you put up the tree, I say. In a dozen years of marriage, not once has Matthew put up a Christmas tree on his own. I'm always the one dragging it out a couple weeks before Thanksgiving, and he's always the one begging me to wait. I know it's not my thing, but I thought you'd like it. I love it, I say, wrapping my arms around his neck and planting a scatter plot of kisses across his face as I notice a shiny snowman floating in the middle of my office. You got me a balloon? What am I, 10? Yes. Duh, Matthew replies, and he's right. At 35, I still purchase an embarrassingly large portion of my clothes from the children's department, and I retain a strong affinity for bright colors and anything Hello Kitty. I also pack the fridge with Kit Kats and pomegranates, he adds, puffing out his chest for emphasis. Way to pull out all the stops. Let's start with the Kit Kats, I proclaim, plopping down on the couch between our corpulent cats, Keshmesh and Nazanin. Matthew hands me an open Kit Kat bar. It must be defective. It only has 3 sticks, he says, visibly chewing on the allegedly absent one as he picks up Keshmesh and sits down next to me. He cradles her in his arms like a newborn, a move most cats would violently resist, but one she seems to relish. Presumably feeling neglected, Naz proceeds to take up residence on my chest, forcefully nudging and licking my face. Look, I announce between licks, we're all here. We can take off. Where do you want to go? Nowhere, I reply, nuzzling my head against Matthew's shoulder. I'm happy at home.
Melody Moisey reading from her book, The Rumi Prescription. She is visiting associate professor of creative writing at UNCW. Professor Moisey, listening to that, I wanted to laugh, but didn't want to interrupt you and ruin the sound. But I have to note that when you talk about being a sucker for Christmas in that story, the first thing that you mention is lights. And this is one of the things that strikes me about all of the midwinter celebrations. It's the, you know, we're getting to the winter solstice, the shortest night of the year, and whatever your religious tradition or celebration happens to be, or secular tradition, lights are always a part of it, finding the light and seeing the light and honoring the light. How would Rumi talk about that?
You know, we have in Iran, we have a celebration in December that is Shab-e Yalda, exactly. We call it Shab-e Yalda, which is what you just called the winter solstice, right? The longest night of the year, the darkest night of the year, right? The longest period of dark. And what we're supposed to do in Iran is celebrate. We're supposed to dance all night during this longest, darkest night of the year. And that is, I mean, that's what I think Rumi would say, is to celebrate. And that is exactly what we do in Iran. And that's what we do here. And I think all over the world where it gets dark, right? Whatever time of the year that is for you, whether you're in the Northern or the Southern Hemisphere, there is an attraction toward the light. And Rumi says that it's not what is best about us that summons the beloved and the light. What he says, it's our wounds that summon the light here too. But he reminds us that this sacred light, it does not come just from you. And that's from one of his poems. That's from one of his couplets, where he insists that that light that our wounds summon to us is something divine that lives within us, but also comes from something greater than us that connects all of us. And I think searching for that light at this time of year is something all of us do. And it does connect us. And however we celebrate it, I think, I mean, whether through Hanukkah, which is such an obvious example of that, right? Or through Christmas, or through Shab-e Yalda, or through Kwanzaa, like we're all looking for light in this moment. And I think now, certainly in the year of 2020, we're all looking for it.
And it's interesting because the message seems to be lean into the wounds, experience the wounds. You talk about maybe what we think of as curses in life are actually blessings. And you tweeted that what the world calls your liabilities, those are actually your assets. And you said, construct your own narrative. What does that mean? And why is it so important to understand that the world's view of liabilities or curses or wounds. That's actually the pathway to the light. Why? How do you practice that?
I really think constructing your own narrative is it, because if you don't construct your own narrative, then the world will construct it for you. And I think that being a member of a minoritized community, that's a dangerous thing, to let the world's version of who you are and what matters to you be the thing that you absorb. And it's very easy to absorb. So being from that background, you have to actively fight it. And that's part of constructing your own narrative. Because like I said, if you don't, then the world constructs it for you. And if I trusted the world's version of what my narrative was, or what it could be, you know, I certainly wouldn't be where I am right now. And there's a common, I think Kamala Harris said it during her acceptance speech. I think you've heard, I think it's a Billie Jean King quote, that you have to be it, or you have to see it to be it, right? And for me, if I waited for that, if Kamala Harris waited for that, certainly neither one of us would be where we are, right? We haven't seen someone like her before, but guess what? She became it. So for me, that's sort of the message of Rumi's poetry, is to embrace who you actually are and to construct that narrative for yourself instead of letting others construct it for you, and instead of waiting for others to set an example for you to follow, because you can pave your own path.
Yeah. You know, I want to talk a little bit about wanting, because the holiday season, especially because Christmas dominates in December in American culture, there is so much consumption, so much consuming and stuff and amassing stuff. And and so much of it is about stuff. This is a very weird holiday season, because a lot of people are grappling with a partial shutdown. There are some people in other parts of this country that are grappling with full shutdowns. Larger family gatherings are fraught potential minefields. There are people who will flout the CDC recommendations about that. There are others who are just living in fear and feeling very isolated right now. What do you think we could take from Rumi on that front? And how can we kind of lessen our isolation and keep our focus on what this holiday season really could be about?
Those are such great points. I think Rumi, and there's a whole chapter in the book, it's the second chapter, is on isolation. And Rumi's prescription that I provide for that is invent, don't imitate. He has a poem where he says, become the sky and the clouds that create the rain, not the gutter that carries it to the drain. And he has another couplet where he says, though the song of the nightingale you may learn to compose, you still can't know what it sings to the rose. And so his message is, quit trying to be a nightingale if you're not one, because you're still not going to understand its language. His message is, stop trying to imitate others. And it's easy when you're trying to fight isolation to try and fit in, right? To try and be like everybody else. But his message is that we're all different, and that is something to celebrate, right? And that this song that we have to sing, there is a song that only we can sing. And so many of us leave this planet without having sung it. We just keep trying to sing somebody else's song. So his message would be, in this moment of isolation, we have an opportunity to create something, and to create something new, which may seem like an individual pursuit, but it's not, because each one of us has this ability to create something new that nobody else can create. And when we each do that, that's how we build true community. The way you build a cult is by imitating other people, right? So I would much rather, and Rumi would much rather, that we build communities instead of building cults. And I think over the past year, even 4 or 5 years, and some would argue much longer than that, we've become really good at creating cults, and not so great at creating community. So his message would to be create something, which ultimately is something we do without having to purchase anything.
Yeah. You mentioned in your story that you start watching Christmas movies around Halloween. We just have about a minute left, but what's your favorite Christmas movie?
You know, my favorite one is with Queen Latifah. It's, I think it's a they've remade it from something else, but it's called Last Holiday. And it's so sweet. I love it. There's a lot of others, but that is absolutely my favorite.
Okay, what are a couple of the others? Give us your top five Christmas movie list.
Oh, wow. So there's another one just called Holiday. They're very original with the title. So there's another one just called Holiday that is, that one I think is with Cameron Diaz and Kate Winslet. And I love that one as well. And there's another one, I think it's called like The Family Stone with, it's got a ton of people in it, including I think Sarah Jessica Parker is one of them, and Luke Wilson's in it as well. There's a new one that just came out on Netflix, which is like a lesbian, I think it's Netflix, it might be Hulu, I forget which one of the streaming services, but it's like a lesbian love story with a girl who's in Twilight, I forget her name, Kristen Stewart, I think that's her name, and somebody else, and I love that. I just watched that and I really liked it.
And we'll have to put this up with resources, but that's our time. That's this edition of Coastline. Melody Moisey, what a pleasure to have you with us again. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks also to Zelda Lockhart. Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Today's show was engineered by Andrew Craig. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.